Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Saturday, November 21st, 2020. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and even Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. Give it a 5-star review. Let everybody know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 465. I have a super special guest, actor, writer, director, producer, Sujata Day from HBO's Insecure, Awkward Black Girl, and a host of other TV and film projects. I'm going to share that conversation that I had with her with you in a bit. Before that, a couple of announcements. Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you're staying safe and out of harm's way. That's all I'm going to say about that. Second of all, I want to thank two new Patreon subscribers. I want to thank JL Covan and Jen Kwok. That's awesome. Thank you so much, JL and Jen. It's really cool whenever you get a new subscriber to Patreon, but I just want to say it's even more, it makes it mo better. It makes it better when two of those people are your friends and colleagues. So that's fucking awesome. Thank you so much for the support. Be like JL and Jen. Subscribe to Patreon. There's cool stuff back there. I don't know where you say that. But there's cool stuff behind the paywall that you should check out. Also, as a reminder, Failed Running Back, my debut stand-up EP, album, whatever you want to call it, it's out. It's available to listen to download, to stream, wherever you do that. Do it. It makes a good stocking stuffer. Although I don't know how you make a stocking stuffer for something that's digital, but maybe you figure that out. I'm not a genius. So I want to get you to my conversation with Sujata Day. She is a terrific actor, writer, director, and producer. I found out about her through Awkward Black Girl, like most people did. That was the first time I had heard of her. She played Cece on Awkward Black Girl. She was Jay's best friend. And I was like, oh, she's cool. And then I just followed her on social media. And then recently I saw that she had a movie coming out called Definition Please, which is what we're going to talk about mostly in this conversation. And I was able to see it via a virtual screening from the Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival last weekend. And I hit her up. I said, hey, I dig your movie. Would you want to come on the podcast? She said yes. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And we set the time up. We sat down and talked and via, you know, Zoom and all that good stuff. And we had a great conversation. So currently, it's doing the festival circuit. And if you're a nerd like me and you're into these virtual film festival, follow Definition Please on Instagram and see where it's going to be next. If it's in a region near you that you can actually get a ticket and see it, do that. If not, it's going to come to a streaming platform in the near future. We talk a little bit about that. And you'll be able to see it and you'll enjoy it. So without further ado, here is my conversation with the very lovely and talented Sujata Day. Being in the age of the Rona in Cali, how is it?
Well, personally, I've been really productive and I feel sort of guilty about being like, oh, well, I wrote a pilot and I wrote my second feature and I'm working on all this other stuff. And it's been really good for me.
personally. You're like one of those people on Twitter. If you didn't like write the great American novel during this, what were you doing? What were you?
Yeah, like about? What were you doing? If you didn't release Taylor Swift's Folklore, then what's wrong with you?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, is that something that just kind of takes you out of, you know, what's going on, or is it just how you naturally are?
Yeah, yeah, it definitely takes me out of the real world and its issues. And it's not an accident that most of the stuff that I've been writing is comedic. Okay. And so it's really fun for me to kind of disappear into these fictional worlds of comedy that make me giggle while I'm sitting at my desk and as the world burns around me.
How is everybody like in California, like collectively, are they adhering to wearing the mask? Are they social distancing and all that?
Definitely in LA, people are wearing masks outside. I will say it's a little disconcerting because I live off the Ventura Boulevard and there's a bunch of restaurants and bars. And, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, it's just packed with people outside. Wow. And yeah, I realize that things outside are open, but I'm like, that's not social distancing. And nobody has masks on because they're eating and drinking or smoking cigarettes or whatever they do. And I'm like, these people are still like out, like partying hard. And it's really surprising to me because I have just been really, you know, sitting in my room or going out to the patio or trying to take a walk around the block. You know, so I've been adhering, and I know I heard that there's going to be stricter rules maybe enacted this week, but I mean, we'll see what happens. All I know from a professional standpoint is that I have a lot of actor friends who've been working on pilots and shows, and everything has gotten shut down because of cases of corona on set. Throughout cast and crew on studio lots and even in, you know, Canada, Vancouver.
Yeah. I've done some like online or like not on, but like self tapes and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, maybe I did get it. Maybe they just shut things down. Maybe I did book it. That's what I'm just whatever. Anyway.
Yeah. So you're staying positive. I love that. I just had a really awkward Zoom producers session yesterday.
Okay.
Where it was on Zoom and there were like 10 producers there, but all their cameras were off. So awkward already.
Yeah.
And it was a comedy. And the casting director who was reading with me also turned her camera off.
That's weird.
And I was like, wait. So I'm just like acting with a blank screen. You think that I'm going to do my best work doing that? And I was just like, I guess I'm an actor. I just have to pretend that someone's standing in front of me.
Auditioning is already one of the most inauthentic things that you can do. And it's then to put another barrier in it. It's crazy. You would think that they would at least try to let you connect with them via the camera being on.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't surprised about the producers' cameras being off because I had a couple other producer sessions before and they had theirs turned off. But the casting director turning her camera off really threw me for a loop.
Was she reading with you, he or she?
She was reading with me.
That's weird. Yeah, that is. That's not. Okay. Well, I hope you get it.
We'll see. Fingers crossed.
it's been interesting because I've had quite a few in the last couple of weeks, and it made me remember that I really love doing it. Just the process. And it's just like, I was like, oh yeah, I really do. This is who I am. I like this. Do you still find that joy in like actually just putting stuff together and submitting and auditioning, or is it just kind of a chore for you?
I don't love auditioning. I really don't. I didn't mind it that much when we were doing it in person because I feel like I'm like good in a room. I'm you know, happy to be there. I'm excited. Good. I'm prepared. And I feel like in terms of auditioning in the age of the Rona, I've gotten lazy in terms of self-tapes, and even with Zoom, live Zoom auditions, I'm just like, yeah, I'm just like setting it up in my room. Like, I don't know what you want from me. And I'm still in my, I'm still in my pajamas. And so that has been different for me, I think, in the auditions. Because I used to really enjoy, you know, driving up to the lot and, you know, having your parking spot there and like walking across the lot and seeing, you know, the other productions that were going on around you. And you felt that excitement, and that's part of it. And so that's definitely missing.
I don't know if I want to ask you about this later, but just like, it makes me think like because the grind in LA is different than the grind in New York, but you seem, it's almost like you're alluding to something to where you still feel the, I guess that joy about being involved in show business, where it's just like, you go ahead.
Oh, I love it. I think it's so exciting. I wake up every morning and I can't believe I get to do what I do. And I definitely still, maybe it's, you know, just hope and stuff, but I wake up and I'm like, oh my gosh, my life could change today. Like, what's going to happen?
That's so cool. That's good to hear, because it's all, because I still feel that way, and I've been like acting since I was a kid, and it's almost, and the higher things get, it's still like that, look at this stuff, isn't it neat? You know, it's just like, you're just like, oh wow, okay, I'm glad that I still feel that way, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure. If I didn't feel that way, then I would try to get out of this, but I do feel that way. I feel excited. I feel like every day there's a new thing that happens, or I get a new phone call or a new email that makes me excited all over again.
And
I would not want to be doing anything else.
That's good. Yeah. That's great to hear. Go.
Of course. I mean, I have like days when I'm down, of course, not all roses and butterflies, but you know, you just kind of take those as they come. You know, I don't book everything I audition for, or you know, I don't sell every TV show that I pitch. So it's, you know, it's just being like, okay, well, there's going to be a perfect tone for this show or this movie, and there's going to be a perfect role for me that I will book at some point. So I just try to keep that positive attitude going.
Sure. Yeah. How are you feeling about the election, about Biden and Harris? You gotta
have pretty good.
Yeah. You gotta have some love for Kamala. I'm assuming you would.
I totally have Kamala love. And I will say, I'm from Pennsylvania. So watching my home state kind of pull through in a clinch was really satisfying. And, you know, I was worried a bit there, because from where I'm from the middle of Pennsylvania, right outside of Pittsburgh. And, you know, it's not the bluest territory.
Yeah, sure. No.
So I was like, I don't know about this one. I don't know if Pennsylvania's going to pull through. But then, you know, Philly really took us there, which, you know, I'm so thankful for everyone in Philly and everyone in Pittsburgh that really got us over the hump. And it's exciting. It's exciting. Yeah. But it's annoying that it's been going on. I feel like it's been dragging on for so long. But in the end, I'm sure we will be the victors.
Yeah, I don't know. I was talking about it a couple of weeks ago, well, last week or whatever, just the fact that there were still 70 million people that voted for Trump. And I don't know. I was kind of mad at myself that I was surprised by it. Were you surprised by that at all? Like, that many people voted for Trump?
I wasn't surprised at all. Okay. And I also was so devastated in 2016. And I was like, I'm never going to put myself through that emotionally again.
Yeah, right.
So I was ready for Trump to win this year. I was like, he's going to win. I'm emotionally prepared. I'm aware of what lies between New York and Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of the country. And so I was a little bit surprised that Biden won, actually.
I don't know. It's just, it's just kind of fascinating how like that all those people voted for him still. And then like, it's just like with show business too, how you get surprised by the way casting goes or projects that get greenlit. And it's just like, I shouldn't be surprised by this anymore. I'm kind of angry at myself for being surprised.
Yeah. You can't be surprised by this stuff anymore, especially after this summer when all the studios and networks made these false promises about, I'm going to put a black square on my Instagram and hire a diversity and inclusion executive to take us through this time period. And nothing's changed. Right. So, you know, the same projects keep getting greenlit with the same actors. And so I was aware that nothing was going to change. But I think a lot of my friends were like, oh, this is going to be it. Like, this is when we're going to sell our show. And this is going to, and I'm like, I don't know. Get back to me in 2 months and see what they're saying.
Yeah, because it's just like all of that stuff during the summer was just bullshit. Like all the protesting, like all these corporations saying, oh, Black Lives Matter, guys, come on, you know, and just it's just, well, what was that? Because so now we get to November and it's just like, so that was just bullshit. And
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So have you seen any type of like shift or change since the Me Too movement and then like all the activism? Has there been any incremental progress at all or no?
I would say there's been incremental progress, but it's not because of Me Too or Black Lives Matter. Okay. I believe it's because of monetary reasons. I believe it's because financial reasons. I believe there are a few more Asian projects because Crazy Rich Asians did well. I believe there are more Black Girl projects because Girls Trip did well and Insecure is doing well. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the changes are happening, but only because studios are seeing the bottom line of it.
Okay.
And I don't think it's because of any of these movements because they don't seem to be listening beyond the initial like social media of the movement, and they don't continue to work towards seeing what's wrong actually at their companies. Like an agency just needs to, you know, hire more Black agents and take on more Black clients. But the thing that they decide to do is create a new role for a diversity executive at their agency. That doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just becomes frustrating, but I still feel like I'm starting to see more like brown people on TV, Black and brown. And like, because when I started doing the show, like almost 8 years ago, I was talking to my like artist of color and they were just kind of like, it's the same. It's just the same. It's just like, no diversity. And I was thinking like just being as a fan of show business and TV and film, it's just like, well, I just want to see something good. Obviously you want to see your people that look like you on screen, but I just noticed that and I started to pay attention to it a lot more. Well, where's the Black version of this? Where's the, you know, let me see some other people.
No, definitely. I mean, what you're saying, like, I do believe that there's incremental progress and we are seeing faces like ours on screen, which is really nice, but I don't think it's enough.
It's definitely not enough. I mean, I remember just when I really started to be like nerding out with really having this obsession with film, I was about 19 years old. And I remember first I started liking these family dramas, like 97, like The Ice Storm, American Beauty, Happiness. And it's like, oh, where are the Black people? Where is that? Where's that version? And it took like 20 years until Waves came out.
That's actually really interesting to me because I also love a bunch of independent films and you know, I love Duplass Brothers movies. And even with my film Definition Please, I was inspired by sibling dramas like Skeleton Twins and You Can Count on Me and The Savages. And yeah. I was like, yeah, where's the diversity? Where are the brown people? Where are the black people? And I was like, I guess I have to make it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess like, I definitely see echoes of that in your film. My first question about the movie is how much of your budget was put into Sheetz?
Great question. Actually, a lot of it. What's funny is that we flew in a lot of cast and crew from Los Angeles, and they had never been to Greensburg before or even Pennsylvania. And when they got there, the hotel that we put them at was right next to like a Monster Sheetz.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's amazing.
It was somewhere that they could walk to.
Sure.
And they were just like, oh, yeah, we're going there every morning. We're getting our breakfast. And I was like, you got it. My favorite thing is a Schmisket. So I highly recommended the Schmisket to everybody. But once we wrapped and everyone left, they all became fans of Sheetz.
I think it's the best. I mean, I went to college, Mount St. Mary's University, which is 15 minutes south of Gettysburg. And we had a Sheetz like 10, 15 minutes away. And that was just an oasis. And so when I moved away to Chicago for theater school, grad school, and was without it for so long, and finally going back, it was great, you know. The last gig, I think the last stand-up gig I did was in Reading, Pennsylvania, and I did it at this like Italian restaurant, and they had all this food and stuff, and I passed the Sheetz on my way to the gig, and I was like, well, I think I'm just going to go to Sheetz after, on my way home. It's the best.
It's so good. It's so good. But I'm surprised you passed up Italian food for Sheetz.
Sheetz is kind of like a delicacy because I'm not around it. I'm not around it that much. Like the closest one to me is in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And so that's like 90 minutes away from me. And then like when I would do shows out there, I would go. I would just book the show so I could go to Sheetz after.
That's awesome. That's in your rider.
Yeah, yeah. But what I really love this movie because of what we started talking about just now, because it was about a family, almost like it was evocative of all three of those movies. But it was people of color, brown people. It was Asian people, you know what I mean? South Asian. It had just as much heart, just as much comedy and all of that. But to me, even though this was, I want to see what you think about this. To me, even though it was a vehicle for you, it was like written, directed, produced by you, you're acting in it, you're the lead. It almost, to me, seemed like you were facilitating a showcase of all of your talented friends.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Because I knew when I set about writing the script for it, I started writing it in 2017 and, you know, finessed it throughout 2018, doing lots of rewrites and notes from friends. I knew that I was going to be doing all those jobs that you just mentioned. So writing, producing, directing, and acting. And I was actually a little selfish because I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to like take on the responsibility as an actor to, you know, carry that mental illness of it all.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to place that on my brother's character. So that I am reacting to him, because I knew I was going to be so busy doing all these other things that I wanted to not be super challenged by the role. And then when Ritesh Rajan read the role, he was like, whoa, I am so excited to play this. I've never had the opportunity to play this before. So I was definitely really excited to give him the opportunity to play this role that he'd never played before, to kind of show off a lot of his acting that he hasn't been able to do in previous projects. And then even with Anna Kaja, who plays the mom, she's so wonderful. And she comes from the theater and she's actually known for playing South Asian moms on TV. Right. So she plays Priyanka Chopra's mom on Quantico. She played Jamila Jamil's mom on The Good Place. And she had previously played Ritesh's mom on a show that he was on called Stitchers. And she also read the script and was like, wow, I go into reading these projects thinking that I know what these moms are going to be because they all kind of follow a certain stereotype or storyline. But your mom character was so full and alive and, you know, filled with all these intricacies that she had never, once again, she had never read before. So it was really exciting for me to give my friends, like you said, my friends, the showcase and be able to allow themselves the opportunity to be seen in a different light in terms of their acting career.
Yeah. It's like you were like, prime Chris Paul, like facilitating except you're hopefully there's more awards in it for you. You know, there, it was like, because I noticed how Monica just kind of, that's your character for the listeners. My favorite scene in the film is when you and your mom are in the tree house. And it's, I think, like you're in the foreground and she's just like talking to you and you're just like taking everything in and processing. I noticed like Monica was doing that throughout most of the movie. Like she was on the precipice of something throughout that whole, it's a week, right?
It's a week.
Yeah. And so it just, and then we get, I don't want to spoil anything because I think with this film on the surface, it's, to me, it's like, it's your typical person that's like in a rut or she's trying to figure something out. And then something happens that makes that character. But then it's a little more nuanced because of things I don't really want to talk about to spoil it. But it was just like, I was like, oh shit. Me and my friends called a swerve. You had a couple of swerves in there that was like, oh shit. Cause normally it's like you, in a movie like this, it's like Greta Gerwig comes to her old town and fuck shit up. And then stuff gets messed up. And I like her.
Definitely. Even like a Zach Braff in Guardians. Yes. I think we all kind of go through that stage of our lives, even if we go through it multiple times, you know? And it's part of, I think in Indian culture, like it's not, our parents kind of love us to be at home, if that makes sense. So once we turn 18, they're kind of like, oh, can you stay home and go to college instead of like going away to college? Because they just, that's like part of our culture in some sense. And so I did want to emphasize, like, she's at home. And yes, it may seem like part of her loserness, you know, she like didn't amount to anything. She was so promising as a child. She won this national spelling bee. And you would think that she's off working at some research lab at NASA or, you know, designing airplanes at Boeing. And she's not doing any of those things. She's just like tutoring kids in her neighborhood. And you're like, that's what a teenager does.
I still didn't think she was a loser though. I thought she just wasn't like, she's not utilizing her, you know, she's not using her gifts to have a better life. But I just, part of me just felt like she wasn't a loser. She just kind of needed a kick in the ass.
Yeah, definitely. She definitely needed a kick in the ass and she was definitely in a rut and she didn't know how to move forward. She just like stuck in this quicksand without any branches there to pull her out.
Yeah. And it was like, cause there was one scene that reminded me of Good Will Hunting when your brother says, I want to come up to this treehouse and not see you anymore.
Yo, I pulled that from Good Will Hunting.
Was I the first person to bring that up?
Yes. Thank you so much.
From a nerd to a nerd. So
I love that you got that reference.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. I was like, oh shit. I was like, yeah. Cause it was just like, instead of seeing about a girl, seeing about a job, you know, guys a couple hours away, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really dug it. I was talking about the movie on the episode that I posted this week. And I was just saying, it just kind of reminded me of like this, like a love story between a brother and a sister. And it was sort of like this, like, I really like the flashbacks and the placement of them about the dad. Cause the dad, that like, that was like, it's like you're showing your hand a little bit as a director, but it's like, we don't know who this dude was, what he was like. We have some idea, but we know he was loved, but there was stuff that was complicated. And I really just like how you handled that. How did you shape that? Like, I kind of want to pair that with the question of like, the pacing of the film too. Like, was there stuff that you cut? I mean, cause it's just like a tight hour and a half, right?
Yeah. It's a tight 90 minutes.
I wish that I could have seen it twice. Like I watched it Saturday night, and then the next day I just kind of like skimmed through some scenes and stuff. But I wish I could see it again, because it's like I was thinking about, and then I'll let you talk. But I was thinking about how, like, you set it up. She's a winner of the Spelling Bee. And then you fast forward to the thing she's got to take out for her mom. And then, boom, like the conflict is like right there. And it's like I noticed that when I was watching it. But the second time around, I was like, oh, shit. Like, it's there already. How did you talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. You would definitely notice it more on the second time because you understand what's happening with Sunny's character the second time around. The first time around, you're kind of like, why is she being so mean to her brother? And then you realize it as the movie goes on. And in terms of it being a tight 90, the script was 90 pages long.
Oh, okay. All right.
The script was 90 pages long, and everything that was in the script made it into the movie. Okay. And I think we only switched around a scene or two to make the story a little more cohesive, but everything else was written on the page, and we didn't improvise at all, really, unless we improvised after the scene was over, just to keep the convo going. But yeah, I knew I wanted to introduce the dad character in a way that would be a bit mysterious, because I think even within the family, with Monica and Jaya and Sunny and how they think about the dad, I believe that they are looking at it from so many different lenses. So in terms of going back to those flashbacks, I just wanted to give little hints about who the dad was to every single person. And you kind of notice that he's treating each member of his family in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it was definitely like, it was compelling. Cause it's like, you don't see him, you see him like twice, maybe.
Yeah, you see, well, he's definitely in the opening, because he's like a young dad.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a young dad in the opening, and then he pops up two or three more times after
Okay. Yeah, it was definitely, I just loved how that turned out, and just the pacing was just like really sharp. Definitely noticed it. I just got this new iPhone, and it's kind of a pain. I had never had an iPhone before, so I'm trying to...
Oh, welcome to the iPhone life.
Have I become a lemming or like everybody else?
What did you have before?
A Galaxy Note, a Droid.
Okay.
It was cool.
Yeah.
I figured I could do FaceTime with my parents and all that stuff.
Yeah, the FaceTime thing has definitely helped, especially through Corona.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the origin of, I know that it was based on a sketch, the idea that you had at UCB. Can you talk a little bit about your experience at UCB, like what that was like for you? Because here in New York, I did level one, and then I started stand up. And I know, like, after a lot of the venues closed here in New York pre-corona, people had their stuff to say about it. Like, oh, it was X, it was Y, it was Z. But I feel like if you utilize your time somewhere and you, it'll be all right. But what was the experience like?
Yeah, I had a really positive experience at UCB, and I was there for about 4 or 5 years, and I went through the entire improv program. So level one to advanced classes with Eugene Cordero and Billy Merritt. And they're some of my favorite improvisers. And one of the reasons that I chose UCB was because I was seeing women of color on stage. So I was watching Nicole Byer on stage with Sasheer Zameda, and there just seemed to be more of a welcoming aspect there.
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed all the improv classes. And then I, you know, you make your own practice teams. And I was doing improv. I did like boot camp. I did improv during the day, every day for, you know, a couple months. And you're doing your practice teams. You got your coaches. You do your shows at the clubhouse, and it was really great. And everyone around me was really supportive and wonderful. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to do a sketch writing class. So I took sketch writing, and I think it was one of the only classes that was all women with a woman teacher. And it was great. It was one of the best writing classes I've ever taken. And I remember after doing all the improv and all the sketch, I was like, oh, I like got to take a break, because I had been writing a lot and I had been pitching a lot. And I had been spending so much time at UCB that it was getting in the way of my writing career. So then I took a break from UCB to just focus on my writing and creating and producing. But I didn't leave because, you know, anything negative had happened or anything. Mm-hmm. And even I've gone back to perform in the Asian AF shows, which are so cool and so great. And so when I was in that sketch class, you know, you have to come up with a sketch a week. And it's pretty, you know, there's a lot of pressure. And you're just like, oh, my God, how am I going to come up with all these ideas? And you just try to get inspired by different things. And I was like, oh, I was in a spelling bee once, and I'm into spelling bees. So I decided to entitle one of my sketches, "Where Are They Now? Spelling Bee Winners." Mm-hmm. And modeled it after like those MTV VH1 shows of like, "Where Are They Now? Rock Star. Where Are They Now? You know, Child Star." And as I was doing research on the sketch, I would pull up that, oh, this former spelling bee champion won the National Poker Tour, and this former spelling bee champion is now a triple PhD and does stuff at Stanford University, and, you know, it's working on the cure for cancer. And I was like, whoa, all these people are just like brilliant and amazing. And so the button of my sketch was that one of the former spelling bee champions turns out to not amount to anything at all. Yeah. And so that was, you know, it's a 4-page sketch with all the heightening and the comedic beats. And then that was in 2015. Okay. And then in 2017, I just was reading back on my sketches, and I was like, oh, I feel like this spelling bee sketch is an interesting premise for a feature if I explore why she didn't amount to anything at all.
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
Yeah. And so that was kind of the birth of Definition Please.
And so right there, you were in between doing Awkward Black Girl and like in the midst of recurring on Insecure. And what about, and when did Cowboy and Indian come about? Because that seemed like, was that like the catalyst that kind of propelled you into kind of doing what you're doing now, just being like a multi-hyphenate, and just the project that sort of put you here in where you are?
Yeah, Cowboy and Indian. I had just taken my first trip to Joshua Tree with a friend. Mm-hmm. And I was just amazed and super inspired by the desert and the cactus. And I was like, this is wild. It just feels like the middle of nowhere. And I just had this idea come up in my brain of, oh, like, what's a play on words? Like, I'm Indian and there's the cowboy, or is it cowgirl? And, you know, I was just like kind of brainstorming titles in my head. Didn't have a story yet. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that idea was born. And then I came back home from that trip and just started jotting down ideas, and I decided on cowboy and Indian. And I'm a huge fan of early Tarantino films. So the premise of Cowboy and Indian was basically, what if one of the women in Kill Bill was Indian? Mm. So that was the premise. And I just built the script off of that. And yeah, like you said, I wrote, I produced, I starred in, and I directed it. And it's an 8-minute short. And so that was the baby project that I suppose I practiced on to get me ready for Definition Please, because I did all of those same roles in Definition Please.
And can you talk about your, maybe your, like, you being in the festival circuit with that, and then eventually going to Sundance, and your, is it, oh, the director of Gook and Miss Purple.
Oh, Justin Chan.
Justin, can you talk about that? Like, with like going to seeing him in premiere Gook, and then you just tell us that story, because I think the listeners would enjoy that.
Yeah. So in late 2016, I think I already mentioned that I was devastated from the election. Sure. And I had gotten into a Sundance screenwriting lab, which was 3 days after the election. So we're all kind of sitting there despondent in this lab, sitting in a circle, introducing ourselves. And I said my name and I just like burst out into tears. And then I think I opened up some emotional gateway for everyone else, though, because as everyone else introduced themselves, they also burst into tears. Mm. And had just amazing time at that lab and met the best people. And it was very supportive and inspiring. And then that was late 2016. And once you go to one of the labs, you are automatically considered an alumni of Sundance Film Festival. And I had never been to the film festival before. So I said, oh, okay, cool. It's 2017. I'll just go to the festival and, you know, see what happens. So my friend Justin Chan's film Gook was premiering there, and I went to the premiere and was completely blown away by the project. I loved it. It was beautiful, great story, amazing acting. And then I cornered him at his after party and I was like, how did you get this made? Tell me everything. Tell me all your secrets. And he's like, girl, I just, you know, I wrote it. I scraped together money from my friends and family and we just shot it on our own. And I was like, fabulous. That's what I'm going to do. And so 2017, that was the kind of the push I needed to start writing my script for Definition Please. And like I said, I continued fine tuning and writing it through 2017, 2018. And then in 2019, with HBO, and you kind of other film is Purple is playing.
Sujata, you kind of turned you turned into a robot for like 5 seconds.
Oh no.
You went to you workshopped it 2017, 2018, and then
okay, great.
Yeah.
So I workshopped the film 2017, 2018, had a pretty decent draft at the end of 2018, and then I went back to Sundance in early 2019 with HBO. And Justin's next film, Ms. Purple, was playing there. And I was like, what am I doing with my time? Why haven't I made my film yet? Mm. He's made 2 movies. And so I just made the decision then and there. I'm going to shoot my movie in June of 2019, come hell or high water. Mm-hmm. And once I made that decision, I got an email while I was at Sundance. I had previously sold a show to a studio and there was a merger happening. So they contacted me to tell me that they were going to return the rights of the show back to me along with a huge check. And I was like, well, if this isn't a sign, then I don't know what is. So
yeah.
I put that entire check towards my film. So technically, I was the first money into my film. And once I was an investor, it was actually a lot easier to convince other investors to put money into the film as well.
That movie was like, Gook was so good. It had been on my list to watch. And then as I was just like researching like your film and just listening to like other interviews and things of that nature, I said, let me just watch Gook. And God damn, like it blew me away. Like it, like my favorite movie of 2017 was Columbus. I don't know if you've seen that with Kogan.
Yeah, I've seen Columbus. It's great.
So it was like, my friends hate every time I mention it. So I don't care because I love it so much. I talk about it. It's just so funny. It's just like two of my favorite movies within the last couple of years have been two Asian American guys that made it, you know, Gook and Columbus. And it's like, that's fascinating. You know, it's there should be more people telling these stories, you know.
There should be more. And it's like, it's such a struggle to get these movies made. And even after Justin made Gook, it was still a struggle for him to make his next film. And that really shouldn't be the case.
Artists like Mindy Kaling, was she any type of inspiration to you?
Yes, for sure. I feel like a lot of the brown creators that have come before me, so Mindy Kaling, Kumail Nanjiani, Hasan Minhaj, Aziz Ansari, they've all been huge influences. And I think they truly opened the doors for the rest of us.
Yeah.
So I'm really thankful to them. And I love a lot of their work. And it's super inspiring.
Because I just happened to be, because like Diwali was last weekend, right?
Yes.
I was and it just made me want to watch that Diwali episode of The Office. That was the first time I had heard of it. And I think I was like 26. I mean, and when I watched it, I was reflecting back on that, like that, when it first came out, that was one of my favorite episodes. And she wrote that and she infused her culture into this American, white bread, apple pie, really good television show. And it was like, that was masterful. Like that was just like when and hindsight is 2020, but like looking back, like it was just really good. And did that have an effect on you? Like, you know, coming up, seeing that?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I think one of my big things when I was writing Definition Please was I wanted this South Asian American family to be themselves. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up as a kid, I went to super white public high school / middle school. Mm-hmm. But on the weekends, I would be hanging out with my Indian friends because there were three temples in my region. And I was taking dance classes at the temple. I was going to Hindu summer camp. I was going to Diwali festivals. And I had the best of all worlds. I never felt conflicted by my culture. So with Definition Please, I wanted the culture to be there. And they're just, you know, a family that happens to be Indian. But I also didn't want the culture to be a plot device. I didn't want them to be conflicted by their Indianness.
Wait. So you're saying you didn't want Monica to have an arranged marriage? Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God. Did not want anybody to say arranged marriage in the movie at all.
Because I think the more specificity you have in a movie like yours that you did have, it just made stuff more universal. I think that good filmmaking does that. So it was just like I think about the grocery store scene. That is that the drink thumbs up? Is that what
it's
called? Is that like,
yeah.
What is that like? What's the American equivalent to that?
So when I spent a lot of summers in India, and you would, you know, get sick, you would get stomach upset, you would get diarrhea. Yeah. You're in India, you know, and the thing that would settle your stomach or cure you would be thumbs up.
Okay.
And so we were just guzzling thumbs up while we were over there. And there were rumors that thumbs up had three times the amount of caffeine as Pepsi or Coca-Cola, because it has that brown cola taste.
Yeah.
And so even when we came back home to Pennsylvania, we would seek out thumbs up in the Indian grocery stores and have our parents buy it for us. And
so that, I was just gonna say, so that's like the Indian equivalent of ginger ale for, like, ginger ale is like Black people's
but thumbs up is so good, and it does make you kind of bounce off the walls, which is okay. Incredible.
The grocery store owner Parvesh, he went to my conservatory, he went to Roosevelt in Chicago. But I think he had already left by the time I got there. He was the first success story, the first person to like really do something from that school. It's really cool. Yeah,
Parv is awesome. I've been friends with him for a while, and I, you know, just texted him and I was like, "Hey, would you mind coming out to Pennsylvania and shooting this one scene for us?" And he came, and of course he killed it and made it his own. And then his best friend, Sonal Shah, plays Dr. Ali.
Okay.
Plays Jaya's best friend. I'm not sure if you remember. The doctor who keeps hitting on Sunny.
Yeah. It was kind of weird. Like this, I rewatched that scene. I wish I could see that shit again. I will buy it when it comes out. But the second time I watched it, is like, oh, she's hitting on him. Because at the end of the ceremony for your father, she was hitting on him. But I was like, okay, she's hitting on him. But then the first time, I didn't recognize that until the second time. I was like, oh shit! All right, you know.
Yeah, and we didn't just on that until she got to set and. She made the character a little younger than I had envisioned. So I was like, okay, we'll just go with that. And then I just saw some natural chemistry and flirtation happening. And I was like, oh, we got to work that into the movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Can you talk about the love interest in this and the guys, or even just the guys that Monica finds attractive when you have the device of Monica spelling the words? Was it, I think I know the answer, but was it your choice not to have the love interest be white?
Definitely my choice. But I will say in the beginning, you know, when I wrote the script, it was just written as no ethnicity. Sure. I didn't write it in there. And then when I got together with my producers, we were discussing some white actors for that role. And I just wasn't feeling it. And I had just met Jake at the same time that I had met Anakaja at a East West Players Gala. And Jake and I presented an award together.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, this guy, Jake, he's got really good energy. He's friends with a lot of my friends. I think he'd be really good for this role. So I just texted him and he was like, yeah, I'm on board, even before reading the script. And I was like, oh, sweet. This is great.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I was really happy that we made that decision, because once again, I think in the entire movie, I'm not highlighting stereotypes at all. So I'm kind of playing against stereotypes the whole time. So it was really nice to have this Asian love interest and have him seen in a very sexy way, mm-hmm. because I don't think that happens a lot. And, and in terms of just the males in my film in general, a lot of women have remarked that they are all very good looking.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's good because it's like, as a viewer, you oftentimes try to put yourself in. If I was in this, who would I be? Like, who would, you know, just like put yourself in there. And it's just like, I don't want to get canceled for saying this, but it's just like, when you see somebody, a woman of color that's attractive and she's the lead in the movie, it's like, she's with a white guy, man. You know, you just want
to. Definitely. I wanted to play against that stereotype.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of the shows that I watch and movies that I watch, I have that same reaction when I.
Okay. Thank you. Cause I.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, and I just get like a little disappointed.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, like they could have done something different here. And then for me, where I had all the power in terms of definition, please, I was like, okay, I'm going to use that power and I'm going to make a change and show these guys that aren't normally seen as romantic interests. Like even Dr. Chu,
mm-hmm.
who gives us the news about our mom towards the end of the film. I'll tell you, you know, behind the scenes, all the women who were on the crew were watching the monitor.
He's a good looking dude. That's undeniable. That that made me think about this, something I was trying to write from my stand up about how, like, some of the most beautiful women that I've seen in real life, in the, you know, just in real life, have been medical professionals. And you see them and they're just like, you just like, I think I'm just going to get this checkup. I'm like, oh my God, you know, what do you, and it's, you just feel like Chris Hansen on those. You're just like, what are you doing here? Why are you?
So I have one of my childhood friends who, you know, coincidentally is named Monica. She's Indian American.
Okay.
And she became an anesthesiologist and she looks like a Bollywood movie star.
Okay.
So you're absolutely correct that some of these, you know, women and men that become doctors, you're kind of like, why aren't you like on the cover of Vogue?
Oh, you just want to help people.
I was like, you must be a really good person.
Yeah. Like I was getting glasses earlier this year and, I got my eyes checked and was doing a fitting and it was just like one, like a really pretty woman in her late 20s. She's fitting. I said, oh, what about these? And she said, no, those aren't good. Don't get those. And I'm like, I'm listening to you. And then like the woman who like actually built the glasses and put them together, she put them on me and she was just like, she said, okay, you're good. And I said, you know, I don't think these fit. And she said, no, you're good. And I was like, yeah, I guess I'm good.
She's being honest. I love that.
Yeah, and then I had to take them back because they were too loose. So she straightened them up.
Oh no! They didn't fit.
They didn't fit. I let her beauty tell me that. You know, I was like, okay, maybe you're right. You're right. No, but I really appreciate. There were just so many things that just made me. It just made me appreciate the film even more because of those things. Because of those things that I felt like. Viscerally connected to, like the mental illness I have that in my family, and just those that doctor thing. Because thank you for confirming that I am not crazy about attractive people in the medical professional field. I feel like this whole conversation was meant for me to feel better about that. I want to also, just since I have you on here and since I had an actress, Jess Salguero, who's a Canadian actress, very talented. And we were talking about the grind of the audition before you got to this level where you're becoming that mogul that you'll eventually be. What were those lean years like? I know the story of you getting a big job at Accenture. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then what it was like before you got to do, you know, Cowboy and Indian, before you were really like cemented yourself into the industry.
So thankfully, because I had taken the Accenture job for a year before going for the entertainment industry 100%. I had built up a safety nest for myself because I was getting paid really well at Accenture. And as a 20-year-old, you're just like, oh, cool. Like, I'm getting all this money and I have nothing to spend it on, because what do you spend money on as a 20-year-old? And so when I did get laid off, once again, it was really amazing because I was getting unemployment and severance for close to a year. Like, I think 8 to 10 months after I was let go from my job. And even before I had been laid off, I started putting in all those things that I needed to do. I got an agent. I got my headshots. I went into acting classes. I started auditioning. And so then after I got laid off, I think it was about a year later, where I booked 3 national commercials in a row. Now, that was like completely beginner's luck. I was like, oh, this is easy. Yeah. This, what are people talking about? The grind. And of course, I have literally not booked a commercial since. So I booked those 3 national commercials and I started getting paid really well from those commercials. And then I started writing a lot, and I had been writing in middle school and high school. And even in college, I took a semester of playwriting and a semester of screenwriting. So I decided to really pursue that a little bit harder. And I did the whole thing of like auditioning for student films, auditioning in LA. There's all these great universities. So you're going to go audition at USC, at UCLA, at Chapman University, at, you know, just universities in this area. So I was building up my reel and doing all these things for what's it called? Like later pay, where you never get paid.
Oh, wow. I never heard of that.
Yeah. And then you're just, you know, trying to get your SAG card. And so I had gotten my SAG card through these commercials, and, you know, I just kept working. I kept doing whatever anyone would invite me to do and be like, hey, will you come be in this short that I'm doing? And I'd be like, of course. Yeah. What else am I doing? And so it was a lot of, you know, it's kind of circling back to what we started off talking about, was I continued to stay positive. I had just left a career that I really didn't enjoy. And now I was finally doing something that I was born to do, that I had always dreamed of doing. I was waitressing at a restaurant and I loved every second of it. Really? and all my actor friends would be like, why do you love waitressing so much? And I'm like, well, that's what you dream of, you know, like that's the vision of being in LA and acting and auditioning. You're a waitress, right? And so I was meeting all these fun people, being a waitress and being a hostess at these upscale restaurants in the city. Yeah. And it was really, really fun. And I just treated every moment and every experience with so much gratefulness, because I would wake up every morning and not be at Accenture.
What was that like? I mean, you often mention how supportive your parents were with you. Are you the only child, or do you have brothers and sisters?
No, I have a brother.
Okay. And what does he do?
He's also not in the business at all. Okay. And he's not a doctor or an engineer, and he's just like a very social, cool, fun guy.
Cool. Yeah. I know they were really supportive, but did you ever have to break the news that you weren't going to be doing the businesswoman thing, the engineer? What were you doing at Accenture?
So I was a consultant, which is super confusing to people who don't know what a consultant is. Basically, you go in to this consulting firm,
right,
and you are hired by other firms to go in and like streamline their HR department or their accounting department.
George Clooney and Up in the Air?
Oh, yeah, sort of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So I obviously didn't tell my parents while I was working at Accenture that I was planning to switch over to acting. And then I let them know once I started getting paid for those national commercials, because I knew, you know, my parents are immigrants. I think their number one, you know, issue in terms of me being in Los Angeles was, is she going to be able to take care of herself? Is she going to be able to pay the rent? Is she going to be able to feed herself? So it was more about just having a stable career and lifestyle as opposed to exactly what I was doing, because they were always throughout my childhood so supportive of my artistic tendencies. So I love drawing and I love painting and I also love dancing and singing and acting. That I don't think it was much of a surprise. I think it was more of they had to just switch their brains to be like, oh, we thought we had this engineer child, but now she's an actress. And they had all these preconceived notions about Hollywood, but only because of what they know about Bollywood, which is really scandalous and filled with affairs and intrigue and nepotism. And and so they were like, well, how are you going to make it in Hollywood if your dad's not the owner of a studio? Or, you know, so they knew what they knew from Bollywood, like national inquirers. And so I had to kind of educate them on what exactly I was doing, which was concentrating on comedy and creating my own work and writing and shooting my own stuff. And even, you know, I also write songs. And so I was shooting music videos of my songs. And so as they were seeing these videos and the content, they started to get more and more comfortable with what I was doing.
Sure. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, I'm a video game player. You were in NBA 2K20. I didn't play the story mode, but you were in it. Can you talk about that process? Like how different that was? Is it like just maybe the difference between doing like you were motion captured, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, I was mocap. It was great.
And did you know, are you a gamer at all?
I am not a gamer at all.
Okay.
So this whole PS5, like I can't get a PS5. I don't even know what anyone's talking about. And I'm like, I'm so glad I don't need a PS5 because it looks like it's really hard to get them.
I want one, but it's not that serious. But I will say before you get into that, I did not realize this and my listeners are going to roll their eyes. But the man who played your father, is it Sunkrish?
Sunkrish Bala.
Sunkrish Bala. He was a voice in one of my all-time favorite video games, The Last of Us Part II. And
that
game came out this year. It was controversial. It's the best game I ever played in my life. And he was in that. I got to find out what he voiced. But anyway.
That's so cool. I love that. I've definitely seen, you know, the tweets of The Last of Us. So I know it's in the zeitgeist.
I would hold up the box so you could... But it's, you know, I'm a nerd. So can you talk about that, maybe audition process and then up until you booking it and then what the experience was like?
Yeah. So I had met this really great guy, Sheldon Candace, in Sundance at 2018 when I went to Sundance. And in 2018, I was in Arizona shooting a movie called The Bellman when Sheldon hit me up and he texted me and he's like, hey, can you put yourself on tape for this video game? And he didn't tell me what the video game was. And then he sent the information and it was called Flight School. And so I look at it and I'm like, ugh, what is this independent video game that he wants me to self-tape for? And then I was on set, so I just didn't do it. And then 2 weeks later, he's like, hey, I really want you to put yourself on tape for this. And I was like, what is happening? Why does he keep bothering me about this? So then I just like put myself on tape. It wasn't anything serious. I was like, didn't even memorize it. I was reading off the page, sent it into him. And then a couple weeks later, my agents were like, oh, you booked flight school. And I was like, great. I booked an independent video game, whatever. And then I tried to Google flight school to be like, okay, like I'm not like a gamer. So maybe this is like some popular thing that people play. And I was like, is this like a flight simulation video game? Like what character am I playing? So then they flew me up to San Francisco. There were like cars to get to the hotel. And I was in a car with one of the other actors that got booked on the video game. And he was carrying a basketball. And it was just like this young, cool black guy. And I was like, hey, so like, what is flight school? Have you played this game before? And he's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, this is like the job that we're on right now. Like, what is this? Like, nobody told me. And he was like, dude, this is like 2K20. And I was like, what is 2K20? And then he's like, it's like LeBron James's video game. And I was like, okay, what character am I playing? What is happening? I was like, I'm not a basketball player. And then I get to set and I think I'm playing this other character, which is like Mountain Dew Girl. And Sheldon's like, welcome to set. It's 2K20. And I was like, thanks for like letting me know beforehand. I seem like a complete fool because I don't know what's going on. And then they were like, oh, you're the trainer. And I was like, okay, I thought I was like this other character. And so I got all my sides like the day before I shot. And so I was just like in my room, like memorizing my lines. And then we got to set and it was actually, you asked about motion capture, but it was no different than being on a film or a TV set. You know, yes, we have like all those cameras, like we have the helmet on, we have the reflective stuff on our suits, but we're still acting in the space and you're interacting with your other actors, you know? So I was interacting with the young basketball players. So it was really, really fun. And I would say one of the funnest jobs I've ever had to this day. And especially through quarantine, I feel like a lot of people are playing 2K20 and I get hit up all the time. Like, what up, Stacy? Like, so it's really cool. I had such a great time and I'm so glad that Sheldon kept on me for sending in that audition tape because I had no idea what I was in for.
Very cool. Yeah. I get it every year. I'll have to play because you're in that. I'll have to play like the story mode or whatever.
Yeah. You got to play the story mode.
You're like, whatever that is.
No, I know what it is now. My right. Career story mode. I'm like aware of the lingo. Okay.
And then know that you have to buy your man a PS5. So
yeah,
that's what Twitter says. You got to buy your man a PS5. I didn't know. I felt like I was doing it wrong. I was buying all these consoles by myself. I didn't know you had to get a woman to buy it for you. Well, I want you to just talk about we'll wrap it up with this. Just talk about maybe the film being on the festival circuit and where you see this going, you know, post the festival run and what your plans. You don't have to. I know maybe you're working on deals right now, but just as much as you can share.
Yeah, the festival circuit has been really fun because, you know, people like you and so many other audiences have come to find the film. And I'm getting so many great responses via social media or emails or text messages. And even the critics who have been reviewing the film have really loved it. And I'm so, so happy that it's playing at all these really amazing film festivals, really across the United States. And even, you know, we have our Canadian premiere in December, and it's playing in Hawaii right now at Hawaii International Film Festival. And post our film festival run, we're definitely trying to sell it to a buyer or a streamer specifically, because I feel like it'll do well globally and internationally. And also at this time, I'm not trying to get any of my audiences to a live theater so that they can, you know, contract COVID.
Yeah.
So I would love for people to be able to enjoy this movie in their home safely and just be able to stream it really easily. So that's, yes, we're definitely talking to people right now, and hopefully we'll have some news soon about where it'll land. So that's been really fun. And it's a lot to maneuver and communicate with, because I'm doing so many other jobs currently in terms of like, oh, I'm the publicist and the social media coordinator and the film festival liaison and the sales agent. So I'm juggling a whole bunch of jobs in terms of that. But it's all really fun. And our cast and crew is really proud of the movie that we made. So it's been easy getting, you know, Tesh and Anna or Jake to do any of these panels that we need to do for the film festivals. And it's been an amazing journey.
Yeah. Well, you got a terrific film on your hands. And Sujata, thank you so much for hanging out with me and letting me be a nerd about your movie.
Thank you so much, Chris.
All right. That's it for this week. Take it easy, everybody.